This podcast is a production of KCRW and KCRW.com Santa Monica. If you enjoy this program, check out KCRW.com for more than 20 additional programs that you can podcast.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, but prepare yourself for the breaks, check it out.
This week on The Business, the UPN and the WB lived but a short decade, but they changed television forever. Now, the programming president at the WB and a veteran TV journalist have written a compelling and cautionary tale for anyone thinking about starting a TV network. Plus, get out your calculators, it's the tax incentive derby. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Stick around, it's The Business from NPR. It's been a woolly few weeks in Hollywood. After 3 months of hurling epithets at one another, Hollywood studios and screenwriters are locked in a stony silence, which is an improvement over vitriol and name-calling, I suppose. But silence scares everyone in Hollywood. It's the sound of quarterly profits evaporating, Malibu mortgages going unpaid, and Porsches being repossessed. As George Bush the Elder once put it, Tension City. Unnerved by that tension, the studios withdrew a controversial proposal last week that would have messed with the venerable gravy ladled out to writers, known as residuals. So, the gravy's off the table, but no one's talking turkey. Yet. That's because studios are unwilling to be forever locked into paying residuals online. That's where everything's headed, but no one knows how they'll make money from it. So, how will digital distribution work? Who cares, say the writers. Listen to us. We'll tell you how it's going to work. You're going to pay us first, then figure out how you'll make the money. To which we say, finally. When actors do this sort of thing, the response from studios is, yes, right away, Mr. Pitt. Would you like that $20 million in small, unmarked bills? Perhaps the same egomaniacal tactics will work for the lowly scribes. As Jack Nicholson says in The Departed, no one gives it to you. You have to take it. You know, those words didn't write themselves. Elsewhere, if you think U.S. foreign policy is incomprehensible, try Hollywood's. Right now, the town can't even agree on what the word foreign actually means. Is a foreign film one that is made by a foreign country? Paid for by a foreign entity? Shot in a foreign language? One that has a soundtrack by a foreigner? Well, it depends who you ask. Last week, this ambiguity created big problems for two arguably foreign films, Taiwan's Lust Caution and Israel's The Band's Visit. Both films were submitted as foreign film entries for the Oscars, but now both countries have had to substitute new films. In the case of Lust Caution, the issue, believe it or not, is whether or not the Chinese-language film, filmed in Asia, was funded by enough money from Taiwan to be Taiwan's entry. In the case of Israel's film, the issue was how much English was used in the film. Over at the Golden Globes, Hollywood Foreign Press Association members sobered up long enough to find consistency on the topic, years ago creating the Best Foreign Language Film category. As an ironic unintended consequence, two of the 5 Best Foreign Language Golden Globe nominees last year were American movies, Mel Gibson's Mayan dialect Apocalypto, and Clint Eastwood's Japanese language Letters from Iwo Jima. Alas, the Globes are now said to be contemplating a rule change for next year, to better resemble the more prestigious, but less rational, Oscars. Speaking of Oscar, though it only won one of the coveted gold guys, Orson Welles' 1941 classic Citizen Kane is widely considered one of the finest films ever. Now, that one Academy Award is up for sale. On December 11th, Sotheby's will auction off the screenwriting statuette Welles won with Herman Mankiewicz. Estimated top bid? $1.2 million. Remember, folks, an Oscar makes for a great gift for Christmas or Hanukkah. Finally, with so much bloodshed in the world, some good news. The war over inflatable crowd dolls is over at last. A lawsuit between two companies that provide inflatables to make big crowd scenes seem more crowded was thrown out of federal court last week. Crowd in a Box claimed that rival the Inflatable Crowd Company had infringed on their patented inflatable humanoid forms when they used them in movies like Cinderella Man and Seabiscuit. Reached for comment, Inflatable Crowd's founder Joe Biggins said, quote, May the best mannequin win. Now, that's real funny, Joe. Especially if you're one of those blow-up dolls forced out of show business and into the sex trade. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later in the show, states fish for production dollars in the tax incentive derby. But next, how Moesha changed television. No, really? In 1986, the Fox television network went on the air with much fanfare as the Fourth Network, an alternative to the three networks that had dominated TV since the dawn of the medium. A decade later, Fox was firmly established when Warner Brothers and Paramount decided to fight for fifth place with the WB and the UPN. 10 years after that, Fox was still going strong, but the WB and UPN were smelted down into the lowly CW. What lessons can be gleaned from the successes and ultimate failure of the two networks? How did their short lives change TV? And what does their demise portend for the future of the medium? Suzanne Daniels was the president of entertainment at the WB, and she's written a compelling and cautionary TV tale with Variety's Cynthia Littleton. It's called Season Finale, The Unexpected Rise and Fall of the WB and UPN. Suzanne Daniels, Cynthia Littleton, welcome to the business.
Thanks for having us.
The book is called The Season Finale, The Unexpected Rise and Fall of the WB and UPN. Let's start with you, Cynthia Littleton. You've been in TV for a good long while covering this stuff. Why should we care that they're toast? What did the WB and UPN do to television?
Well, Claude, I think they did a couple of things. I think WB in particular, with its success with shows like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Dawson's Creek, Seventh Heaven, Felicity, I think they were kind of a bridge between the era of about a dozen years ago and the era that we're living in now of the continued nicheification of the television landscape. And I think that WB made its greatest impact with shows that were zeitgeist-capturing shows that endure as signature shows of that mid-90s to early 2000 era that had outsized influence on pop culture, much beyond their actual raw Nielsen numbers. And I think that kind of brought us into an era when we can all talk about shows like Entourage and Nip Tuck and, you know, a lot of the cable shows that get so much buzz and so many magazine covers and have the audience of a low-rated broadcast TV rerun on a Saturday night. It seemed like it really heralded the era of both a nichification pushing all networks to become ever more concentrated on a particular audience profile and a particular demo. I think there's no question that the two little networks forced even the big guys to focus more on discrete audience niches as that just continued to splinter the audience.
So why is it, let me ask you, Suzanne, that this happens? And first of all, why does a show like Buffy or Dawson's Creek, why isn't that on a big network? Why does it wind up on a little network like the WB?
Well, at the time, nobody else would buy it but us. I like to talk about our drama development at the WB by saying that we were successful because we knew nothing about what we were doing. The team I was working with, Garth Yancier and Jordan Levin, none of us had a drama background. We had all actually worked in network comedy. So when someone came in and when Joss Whedon walked in the door and said, you know, I'm going to make a series out of a movie that was dreadful and not a success at all, we said, great, which is not the traditional response from someone I think who'd grown up in the drama development business. We just didn't know better, and we took chances because of that. So I think that's why those shows ended up on the network. Dawson's Creek was a script that Fox passed on, and it was developed at Sony Television, and they sent it over to us. And we said, wow, we love this script. We'll make this script. And again, Buffy was pitched to the other networks as well. Nobody else would buy it.
So the fact that someone doesn't want to buy something doesn't necessarily reflect anything about its quality.
Well, we could point to The Sopranos as probably the big shining example of the last decade of a show that was kicked to the curb at every network until it found a welcoming home at HBO. And truly, television history was
The Sopranos
written.
Wouldn't have been The Sopranos at a broadcast network because of language and violence and things that they would have been prevented from
and
doing.
And bada bing, for one thing.
And I think just to cite the Buffy example, I think another key thing about the WB and why Buffy came to life at the WB, Joss Whedon walked into a meeting with executives who were not that much older than him. Whereas at another network, he would have been meeting with, guys and women in kind of starched suits who kind of looking at this oddball, artiste type. Whereas he walks in with Suzanne and Jordan and Garth and Cyr and comes to a much more welcoming
environment. Yeah, Jamie Kellner, the founder of the WB, I think once cut a tie off of Jordan Levin's neck and
he
said,
did.
I never want to see this on you again.
Yes, wasn't a tie and coat network at
yeah.
all.
How did Jordan react to that?
Jordan was happy about it.
Really?
Yes. I mean, I think he liked that particular tie, but he was happy about what, the general statement that Jamie was making.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Suzanne Daniels, the former president of entertainment at the WB, and Variety's Cynthia Littleton. Their new book is Season Finale, The Unexpected Rise and Fall of the WB and UPN. How does the way that these networks, the WB, the UPN, how does the way that they get launched doom them?
When you look at the early launch of UPN and WB, you really see the difference in the management of both networks and the ownership structure of both networks. And UPN was hobbled from the start by trouble between the partners that ran the network, whereas Warner Brothers had more of a uphill climb in terms of how it was approaching the marketplace. It had very strong leadership in Jamie Kellner, and that was the determining factor in its early success.
Mm-hmm. And with the UPN, what happened? Was it just that explain the disorganization there?
Well, UPN kind of came to be within Paramount at a time when the studio was being bought by Viacom. Sumner Redstone went after the studio. And at the time, during that ownership transition, Viacom could not swallow all of the losses that were projected for the launch of a broadcast network. So they went into a partnership with TV station owners, a company called Chriscraft Industries, which by all accounts were not people that had the stomach for the high-stakes, megabucks game of launching a broadcast network. And that led to all kinds of behind-the-scenes strife and agita and made for really difficult times for the people that were actually on the ground trying to run UPN in its first 7 years.
So as both of these networks sort of struggle to get out of the gate, they're broadcasters, but they kind of become narrowcasters. Right? I mean, what happens?
What happens? Well, we need to get on the map. So how do you get on the map? You get on the map by offering something that you can't find anywhere else. And what you couldn't find anywhere else initially were shows featuring African Americans. We also were able to get on the map quickly because those shows were available. There was literally a busted pilot from Fox starring Robert Townsend. There was a busted pilot from NBC starring Sean and Marlon Wayans that were not going forward at those networks that we could pick up at the WB and get into business with them right away and get ratings and get eyeballs and get a little bit of attention and get a little bit of momentum. After that, where we really hit our stride was in young adult programming that really drew in the teen audience, and we made a big statement with that, and we were successful, very successful with that audience.
So the WB decides we're going to go after teens, and the UPN goes after blacks, which is kind of funny because they launch because they've got Star Trek. That's sort of their big franchise at Paramount. And it's like the whitest, practically translucent audience you can find. They're well-to-do and they're white dudes. And then this becomes the network of homeboys in outer space.
And frankly, what it really eventually becomes is the network of the World Wrestling Federation, because that's when they, after Star Trek, made their next biggest splash when they started airing the WWF on Thursday nights.
So, Cynthia, take me through these ensuing years after these strategies are in place. Like, what are the highlights of that 10-year run, basically? What happens along the way? How does television change as a result of all this?
Well, I think most interesting is that for all the strategy and all the plotting that can be done, television is not a science. And a lot of it is taking a gamble on writers that interest you, ideas that spark a creative exec's imagination. And I think why WB succeeded at a level of shows that people remember and still talk about today, where UPN didn't, was I think they just had better management. They were backed in a way that they were able to take shots at something like a Felicity or like a Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I think UPN probably got a little hidebound in they found one thing that worked, so they tried to clone it, you know, many more times on the schedule. I think in general, in the broader picture of television, I think you saw, this was a period when you saw NBC trying to clone Friends and really, really focus in on that must-see, affluent, urban audience. A lot of people would say to their detriment down the road because they got a little too narrow casting on that. For a long time, you had ABC trying to ape NBC and cable exploding at this point. You had a lot of uncertainty and a lot of people at broadcast networks that weren't quite sure where the marketplace was going. And I think a lot of executives at Big Four networks, when they saw the kind of numbers that Dawson's Creek was putting up, they were thinking, wow, we really need to get a little more adventurous. We need to be a little more expansive in our net.
Suzanne, what do you think of that? I mean, you were in the trenches there. I mean,
I don't think it's good to have all these conglomerates, frankly. It creates a reverse funnel, that there are fewer people at the end of the day through which all of the creative people and their creativity have to be funneled through to actually get on the air. And I don't think that that helps television.
Has television changed so much in the ensuing years that the lessons that we might have learned from the WB and UPN no longer apply?
They apply to cable, don't you think? I mean, now that I work in the cable business, now that I work for Lifetime Television, and I look at my competitors, I look at, you know, HGTV and, you know, Sci-Fi Channel, there's a lot of specific niche television cable networks that are thriving and are doing extremely well. And I think the lessons learned apply much more towards them. Although broadcast television is changing greatly. I mean, broadcasting was when you had ABC, CBS, and NBC, in my mind, and you had, you know, 30 million viewers. And, you know, with the exception of American Idol, and I don't think you see that today anywhere in the landscape.
10 million is considered a huge success.
A huge hit today. Yeah. So are they still broadcasters, in fact? One of the things that the WB was really known for was its brand. There was a very strong brand statement there. I believe that's true of my current network, Lifetime, too, in that it's really known to be television for women, and there's a lot of trust and loyalty from our female viewers. But would you argue that ABC, CBS, and NBC have a brand? And if so, what is it? I don't think they do. And I ultimately think they were going to have one in order to survive.
Suzanne Daniels was president of entertainment for the WB and is now president of Lifetime Entertainment Services. Cynthia Littleton has been a journalist covering Hollywood since ever, as far as I'm concerned, and is the deputy editor of news development for Variety. Suzanne, Cynthia, thanks for being on The Business.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
A postscript. The two networks eventually folded because of, to quote the book's dust jacket, quote, conflicting personalities, relentless competition, and a basic failure to anticipate the future of the entertainment business. But perhaps the WB and UPN were just the early casualties. Viewership for the remaining networks continues to drop. After a short break, the Tax Incentive Derby. You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. When you think of Hollywood, you think of movie stars and power lunches. You probably don't think of venture capital and tax codes. but it's the increasingly arcane behind-the-scenes business of show business that determines whether Hollywood's red carpet stays in the black these days. One pervasive element that figures into the cost calculation of almost every production these days is, where will we shoot it? States and countries are fighting hard to bring production to their neck of the woods with financial and other incentives. The business producer Matt Holzman talked to Joe Chianese of the production support company Entertainment Partners about who is winning the incentive derby. And they're off.
Joe Chianese, welcome to the business.
Thank you.
Why do filmmakers come to you? What are they coming to you for?
They come to us so we help them explain what incentives are available in terms of which states are offering incentives, and then we work with them in trying to understand how to apply the incentives. And then we as a company, Entertainment Partners, have software that tracks a lot of the key costs, and we help work with them to use that software to track the key incentive costs.
All right, so let's define incentive. In layman's terms, what is an incentive?
Well, there's a variety of incentives. I mean, you can basically look at incentives by virtue of the city's offering free filming permits or police support. But the incentives that we're talking about are either cash rebates or tax credits. And when you're dealing with cash rebates, those are funds that are directly paid to a production company, and they're not administered through a tax return. When you're talking about tax credits, those are production incentives that are administered and processed through a tax return, and they're either refundable tax credits, so you'll get that back when you file your tax return, whether or not you actually have a tax liability in the state, or they're called transferable tax credits, meaning that if you can't utilize the tax credit as an offset against your own tax liability, then it's transferable, meaning you can sell it or use a broker to sell it to a third party.
But no matter how it's processed, the bottom line is if you spend X number of dollars in a state or country, you're going to get X number of those dollars back.
Correct.
Now, is that a law that a state passes? How does that incentive get established?
Yeah, it's basically based on local law.
Okay.
And it's either administered through the Department of Revenue or administered through the Film Office or Department of Commerce. It depends.
So who is it specifically, writer, producer, director, who comes to you, and at what point in the process do they come to talk to you?
Well, it's usually either a studio or a producer, and they can come to us at any point. They can come to us when they've already chosen a jurisdiction or a series of jurisdictions, and we work through the analysis to see which one would offer the best incentive. And that's not just purely based on the rebate given back, but it's based on other parameters like crew base, available facilities, weather, natural settings. All these are sort of factored in when a location is being considered.
How long have these incentives been around?
It depends. I mean, there's been incentives around for a very long time. I mean, before we actually had these cash rebates and tax credits, the states offered sales and use tax rebates and exemptions, and they've been around for a long time. But I think you started seeing the states bringing about credits in 2000, 2001. Louisiana, Colorado, were the states that first introduced these.
These days, which state or let's separate them, in fact. Let's talk about states first and then countries later.
Mm-hmm.
Who's being the most aggressive? Rather, and we don't want to talk about the specifics of what their incentives are, but which state is really just putting it out there that, you know, this is the place to film and we will give you a lot of money back?
Right. Well, I think the term aggressive may be a little misplaced, but I would tell you, just based on what we've seen currently, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, Connecticut, Florida, Massachusetts, Rhode Island have all seen an increase in production due to their infrastructure, crew base, appeal to the cast and crew, as well as the incentives. It's not just the incentives alone that is going to attract them. It's all got to be factored in.
Which country has been going after filming?
Well, Canada and the UK have been out in the forefront for a while.
Now, Canada, obviously one of the benefits there is they speak English. It's close. A lot of the cities can double for American cities. They've got production facilities, equipment, and all those things.
Mm-hmm.
But they also have incentives.
Correct.
And what are those incentives?
Their incentive is a labor credit. Basically, you get a credit back based on your UK labor. So to the extent you use – I'm sorry, Canadian labor. To the extent you are using Canadian labor, which is why you would go to Canada, you would get a credit, a federal credit, and a provincial credit for your Canadian labor.
Oh, that's interesting. So this is also kind of a jobs bill for them.
Yes, in a sense.
Now, obviously, at one point, one of the main benefits of going to Canada was their dollar was very weak against the United States dollar, so it was cheap just right off the bat to film there. Mm-hmm. That's changed now, and the U.S. dollar and the Canadian dollar are somewhat on par. Is that going to – are we going to end up seeing a lot less Canadian production because of that?
I think the answer is yes. Again, all that's factored in. I mean, when I mentioned the things before besides incentives, you know, crew base, infrastructure, exchange rate is also factored into the equation.
Right. But obviously, that's going to be a major factor of all those. The dollar.
It should be, correct.
Right.
I mean, again, if there was something in Canada that you couldn't get anywhere else in terms of aesthetics or something, then that might overrule the decision. But clearly, the dollar would have a major impact on that decision.
Yes, if you're going to do a hockey film or a film about beavers, Canada, ideal. What effect do you think all these incentives is having on the business as a whole? And do you think it's causing a bit of a race to the bottom, that is, as each jurisdiction, each state, each country goes after production, do they start undercutting themselves to a point where it just doesn't make sense for them to even have the production there because they don't make any money off of it?
Well, I think, you know, every state has something to offer. I think, you know, at the end of the day, whether they're trying to create job growth or skills training or utilize surplus properties, tourism, increase capital investment, there's many goals. So presumably the market will self-correct, and if the incentive itself isn't meeting the goal, it'll be modified or discontinued. So, you know, again, that's pretty much how it's been happening.
So is there a country and is there a state that's really winning this incentive derby?
Well, again, I can just tell you what I've seen in terms of just the trends and the states that are leading with regards to production. California is still clearly number one. Then you've got New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, Connecticut, all states with incentives. Florida, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, again, states with incentives. So clearly the incentives have been have had an impact.
And in terms of countries?
Countries, as we mentioned, Canada has been there for a while. And again, when you're dealing with countries, you have to factor in the exchange rates, as we've talked about. So I think you're going to see Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand have all been countries that I've seen productions go to by virtue of the incentive as well as things that the country had to offer in terms of look and so forth.
It seems like Eastern Europe, though, is really the up-and-comer.
Well, Hungary is another country that has an incentive, and so, yeah, Hungary can, in cities within Hungary, can obviously look like other parts of Europe. So if you have a country that offers an incentive and has a general enough European look that could be substituted for another place, yeah, that's definitely been the case.
Well, thanks for talking with us. Joe Chianese is the Vice President of Business Development and Production Incentives at Entertainment Partners, the largest provider of production management services in the entertainment industry. Joe Chianese, thanks for speaking with us.
And if I could just mention, we also have a website, productionincentives.com, where we highlight all the incentives, both domestic and international, and keep it current with regards to the most current laws and regulations.
That's great. Well, thank you, Joe.
Okay, thank you.
And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.